Now, the prophet Isaiah has got to be one of the best known and most familiar of the Old Testament prophets. In the whole Bible, only the book of Psalms is longer or more frequently quoted in the New Testament. Isaiah's book has even been called like a fifth gospel for all the many important ways that the things that Isaiah says prefigures the story of Jesus. We'll recognize familiar passages from Isaiah's book at Christmas time and Easter. They're sung as part of Handel's Messiah. We recognize some of his words. And yet we rarely give much consideration to Isaiah in his own time, this tumultuous period of the 8th century B.C. And that is where our somewhat familiar text for today, Isaiah's vision and call in chapter 6, makes a point at the very beginning to locate itself. Roughly 740 B.C., at a significant time of transition for the people of Judah and Israel. Or in Isaiah's words, it was in the year that King Uzziah died. I think it's significant that Isaiah dates his vision to a death, to the end of an era. No other prophet does this. They'll say, I had this vision in the third year of King so-and-so. No one else says, the year that so-and-so died. But Isaiah does it twice. The 52-year reign of King Uzziah was a remarkable period of stability and expansion, both for the kingdom of Judah and for their neighbors to the north in the kingdom of Israel. A time not seen since the days of Solomon. But his death would usher in a tumultuous period that would see the rising threat of the Assyrian Empire, the end of the northern kingdom of Israel, and the near annihilation of Judah and Jerusalem. Isaiah would bear witness to all of these events over the course of more than 4 decades in ministry and the reigns of 4 different kings. And at issue again and again and again would be whether or not God's people would trust in him in the midst of these generation-defining events. Perhaps we can relate in our own time of global uncertainty and unrest, when it seems that democracy and climate are at risk, and an age of seemingly unlimited growth and expansion appears to be coming to an end. Isaiah's vision can speak to us today. So Isaiah 6 gives us this context. It was in those days when the nation was mourning the death of a king, wondering what the future was going to bring, that Isaiah had this vision. I saw the Lord, he says, high and exalted, seated on a throne, and the train of his robe filled the temple. Isaiah's vision of the Lord takes place fittingly in the midst of worship, in the temple of the Lord in Jerusalem. But the imagery is royal. He's seen the King, the Lord Almighty, as he says in verse 5. He's seated on a throne, surrounded by angelic attendants, his long flowing robe a symbol of kingly majesty and authority. And the message is this, that Uzziah may have died, as all earthly rulers, good or evil, weak or strong, finally do. But the Lord, the King eternal, is still on his throne. And he reigns not just over Jerusalem, not just over Judah, not just over the land of Israel, but the whole earth is filled with his glory. The theme of kingship resounds throughout Isaiah's book. From faithless and gutless rulers like King Ahaz, to the trust shown by Hezekiah in the face of near certain annihilation. We'll tell these stories over the coming weeks. To the promise of Messiah, whom Isaiah calls Emmanuel, the one who will reign forever with justice and righteousness. But this vision in chapter 6 establishes at the outset of Isaiah's ministry that it is God, the Lord of hosts, the King who is sovereign and who reigns over all. The times may be uncertain or unsettling, even dangerous and threatening. But God, Isaiah's vision assures him and assures us, God is in control. But Isaiah's response to this majestic vision is not one of awe and wonder, but Isaiah responds with fear and dismay. Woe to me, he says. I am ruined, for I am a man of unclean lips, and I live among a people of unclean lips. My eyes have seen the King, the Lord Almighty. In the presence of the Lord's incomparable holiness, Isaiah is overwhelmed by his own sense of inadequacy and sinfulness. Like Peter responding to Jesus' call on the Sea of Galilee when he falls down on his knees and says, "Depart from me, Lord, I am a sinful man." Isaiah is fully conscious of how small and unworthy he is to be in the presence of God. This week I read a story about how about a year ago, 90-year-old William Shatner, the actor most famous for portraying Star Trek's Captain Kirk, had a chance to go to space for real aboard a Blue Origin spacecraft last year. And viewing the Earth for the first time from outer space, he had an experience that he could only describe as deep grief. "I was crying," he said. "I didn't know what I was crying about. I had to go off someplace and sit down and think, what is the matter with me?" NPR reports that Shatner had been excited to travel to space, and he thought about it for nearly 60 years. But he didn't think that he'd be overwhelmed with sadness or that he'd go through these strong feelings of grief. It turns out this overview effect was first identified about 35 years ago, and it's a common experience for astronauts when they first see the Earth in the context of the universe. Isaiah's experience, I think, must have been similar as he saw himself and his people and the whole Earth in the context of heaven and from a divine perspective, something akin to the overview effect. And it changed his perspective forever. Shatner spent years as the captain of the Starship Enterprise, but now he really had this experience firsthand of seeing the Earth from outer space. And likewise, Isaiah, by most accounts, was not new to prophecy. He'd already spoken the word of the Lord during the reign of King Uzziah, according to chapter 1. But now, he was having a face-to-face encounter with the living God. And he would never be the same. In the presence of the Lord, who is holy, 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 Isaiah has an overwhelming experience of his own sinfulness and of the sinfulness of his people. His confession is, "I am a man of unclean lips. I live among the people of unclean lips." Unclean is a really striking word in this context, because Uzziah's last years were marked by ritual uncleanness. 2 Chronicles chapter 26 tells us that after Uzziah had become powerful, his pride led to his downfall. He entered the temple, the very temple where Isaiah's vision takes place, and he attempted to take on the role of the priests and burn incense on the altar in one of the temple's holiest spaces, something forbidden to anyone but the priests. And as he raged and threatened the courageous priests who tried to stop him, 2 Chronicles tells us leprosy suddenly broke out on his forehead. And he was hurried out of the temple. And the chronicler tells us that King Uzziah had leprosy until the day he died. He lived in a separate house, leprous and excluded from the temple of the Lord. His son Jotham had to take over the daily duties of the kingship. And now, mere steps away from the place where the king was stricken unclean in his presumption and pride, Isaiah confesses himself to be a man of unclean lips. In the Old Testament, lips can speak truth or they can speak falsehood. They can harm or they can heal. The scriptures belie the notion that sticks and stones may break my bones, but words will never hurt me. Because the Psalms are full of the laments and the cries of those who have felt the sting of lying lips or a deceitful tongue. The words of the Lord, he says, are pure words. A prophet's task is dependent on lips that speak the truth, that claim to speak for God. Thus says the Lord, is the prophet's refrain. And at this moment, Isaiah is convicted by his failure to do so. Isaiah moved in royal circles. Unlike his contemporaries Amos or Micah, who were from the rural countryside, Isaiah was close to the centers of power. He was the keeper of the annals of the king, possibly of royal blood himself. Tradition names him as a cousin to King Uzziah. Isaiah could be described as a court prophet. And it was always the particular challenge of the court prophets that instead of speaking truth to power, the temptation was speaking as truth what the powerful wanted to hear. Court prophets are rarely praised in the Old Testament, with a few notable exceptions, like David's prophet Nathan, who confronted King David. Most of the prophets come from outside the halls of power. Tradition says that when Uzziah attempted to seize the privileges of the priests, he threatened to kill anyone who stood in the way. Perhaps it was just more convenient for someone in Isaiah's position, a young relative of the king with aspirations of the royal court, to remain silent and not speak out. And if that's the case, that's only interesting. We can see in Isaiah's unclean lips something far more destructive than just the propensity to curse like a sailor or take the Lord's name in vain. But instead, a temptation common to our own time, to distort and to water down the truth to suit our interests or our politics, or perhaps to court favor, telling the powerful what they want to hear. We too, at times, have been a people of unclean lips. Just in one of the seraphs, the fiery angels who waits upon the Lord, approaches Isaiah with a live coal taken with tongs from the altar. Is this the same altar at which Uzziah was struck with leprosy? I think there's a case to be made that it is. See, this is touched with your lips, the angel says. Your guilt is taken away. Your sin is atoned for. Isaiah's lips, purified, cleansed by fire, are now free to be used in the service of the Lord. He's only able to respond to the call of God in the next verse because he has first been restored and set apart. No longer does he merely serve as a court prophet in the service of a king who's now dead and gone, but his mouth is now consecrated to speak a word from the Lord, the King, the Lord Almighty. And it's now that the Lord speaks for the first time in this passage, saying, "Whom shall I send? Who will go for us?" And there's no indication yet even what that mission is going to be, but Isaiah is quick now to speak up, as if from an overlooked corner of the room. "Here am I. Send me." It seems that this experience of God has brought about a dramatic shift in Isaiah's priorities and allegiances. There's no longer any question for Isaiah which king he serves. Still, it's a remarkable response, considering that the likes of Moses and Jeremiah and others said not, "Here am I, send me," but "Who am I, send someone else." But Isaiah's calling is now clear. He's been set apart for this purpose. He realizes that. It was really tempting this week to end the passage right here, because we often do. And we don't really like to read the rest of this chapter. Isaiah receives such an ironic, a counterintuitive commission from the Lord. It doesn't sound like a mission of success and revival.
God says, go and tell this people. Be ever hearing, but never understanding. Be ever seeing, but never perceiving. Make the heart of this people calloused. Make their ears dull and close their eyes. Otherwise, they might see with their eyes, hear with their ears, understand with their hearts, and turn and be healed. If Isaiah had dreams of doing big things for God, changing hearts and minds and leading revival among the people, he was in for a big disappointment. His message was destined to meet with indifference and rejection, insensitivity and hard hearts, eyes and ears and hearts of people closed to his message. And God warns him in advance. The people will refuse to see, to hear, to turn. But this is not to be understood as a failure. The Gospels and Acts quote this passage in the New Testament because Jesus and later Paul had the same lack of understanding in response to their message. Isaiah's ministry may not be what we qualify as a success, but he's in good company. At this point, Isaiah may be reconsidering his eager response to God's call. This is not what he signed up for, after all. And his retort is characteristic of the Psalms of lament and complaint. He says, how long, Lord? Walter Brueggemann explains that this question isn't about a length of how long this is going to go on, how long he's going to carry on a fruitless mission. But this is a question of complaint. It suggests that God is being unfair, inattentive. God's people deserve something better. In a sense, he's asking God, what are you going to do about it? How long, Lord? But the Lord's reply paints a picture of complete and utter devastation for a people blind and deaf, a people of unclean lips and callous hearts. Cities ruined. Homes deserted, fields ravaged, lands utterly forsaken. Is there still time to send someone else? But the success of God's mission is rarely measured according to human standards or on human timetables. And there is at least a glimmer of hope. The text speaks enigmatically of a holy seed left like a stump in the land where a tree has been cut down. This image will recur a few chapters later in that familiar Christmas passage about the shoot from the stump of Jesse, a king from the line of David, who would be Christ the Lord. Isaiah may not see the results of his ministry. It's another 800 years until Jesus comes along. But he's planting seeds that will bear fruit for generations to come. The book of Isaiah is uniquely a multi-generational book of prophecy. Eventually, his words would come to speak to the post-exilic generation more than 200 years in the future and inspire new words from the Lord. And more than any other prophetic book, they prefigure the story of Jesus Christ. They find fulfillment in the gospel. That's why we hear so much of Isaiah at Christmas time. And his words continue to speak today. Isaiah planted seeds that would take centuries to bear fruit. In words that I like to bring around every now and then, words often attributed to Oscar Romero, but actually written by Father Ken Unter, this is what we are about. We plant seeds that will one day grow. We water seeds already planted, knowing that they hold future promise. We lay foundations that will need further development. We provide yeast that produces effects beyond our capabilities. We may never see the end results, but that's the difference between the master builder and the worker. We are workers, not master builders. Ministers, not messiahs. We are prophets of a future, not our own. May we say with Isaiah, here am I, send me.